From Vermont to Alabama, New Mexico to South Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, contact tracing is being touted by healthcare professionals as a key to stemming the spread of COVID-19, but that raises privacy concerns. We are joined by William Reinhart from the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. President Trump has issued an executive order that will remove many of the regulatory barriers to restarting the U.S. economy. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth has the real story. Texas has realized that business closure orders can't be enforced. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine says the same goes for most states, and such forced closures are even counterproductive. And Memorial Day is a time to remember those who have paid the price for our freedom. Unfortunately, parades and services have fallen victim to COVID-19. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. As the nation moves along the slow path to reopening our economy, contact tracing is being touted as a tool to do so while keeping spread of the coronavirus under control. Here to talk about the issues surrounding contact tracing is William Reinhart. William is Senior Fellow at the Center for Growth and Opportunity at Utah State University. William, welcome to American Radio Journal. William, when we use the term contact tracing, it's something that we're hearing a lot of as we attempt to move the country back to normal or something close to normal. For folks who aren't familiar with exactly what the term means, what is contact tracing?
Contact tracing is a really laborious process typically undertaken by public health officials to figure out all of the instances in which a person with, in this case, COVID, has come into contact with other people that potentially also could get the virus itself. And so it's this long, drawn-out process to basically figure out where people have been and then to figure out potential transmissions throughout that pathway. So a lot of the traditional way of understanding it is that you would ask somebody, where have you been over the last couple of days? All that information is collected, and then public health officials go to people that may potentially be infected and ask them if they're having the symptoms and potentially also test them for COVID. And so, again, this is a really laborious process. It's quite expensive, and it's something that at least digital technologies have been suggested to be a potential helpful addition to the traditional manual contact tracing process.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, because there have been discussions of perhaps Apple or some other major provider of technology would be involved in this. So what sort of applications would be needed in order to bring about an effective contact tracing program?
So most of the discussions that are currently being proposed are really still in this kind of manual space. They're really getting people trained to figure out how to ask the kinds of questions to actually do the contact tracing. But at the same time, there's a parallel process happening with Apple and Google that they're actually creating a framework such that public health officials can actually develop apps to speed some of this up. So what we're seeing really, at least this week in particular, is the release of a new set of programs that allow Apple and Google phones to contact each other and effectively start to do at least some of the contact tracing through a digital method. But it should be noted, very importantly, that neither of the companies are actually producing these apps. They're giving these tools to public health officials and really states to go ahead and create those apps. And it should be noted that we'll probably see those applications probably come out in the next couple of weeks as well.
This, of course, as with any expansion of technology and certainly any expansion of tracing the movements of Americans, raises privacy issues and concerns about potential improper use of the data. So what can be done, and can anything be done, to protect the privacy of folks who may end up using a potential app?
At the core of this technology really is a set of tools that's meant to ensure that no one really knows who has COVID, but it allows for transmission of information between phones. There's a whole bunch of other technologies as well. My organization is based out of Utah, and Utah Public Health Department is also putting together its own, has put together its own application, its own mobile app that actually does legitimate tracing through GPS, which is a whole different and separate technology than the one we're talking about with Apple and Google. So there are these kind of parallel tracks that are happening. Apple and Google are putting together their own system, but public health officials, both at the state and the federal level, are looking at these other sorts of technologies, mainly using GPS to track individuals. And I think it's really with those state-based and those federal programs that are currently being discussed, I'm far more concerned about those as being privacy invasive than what we see coming out of Apple and Google, primarily because of the way that the technology is designed through Apple and Google. It just doesn't allow for easy notification or easy identification of people with COVID.
Anything like this, William, of course, requires people to buy into it voluntarily.
Yes.
And Americans, rightly, are deeply suspicious of any tracking or tracing of their personal movements. So is this something that we're likely to get significant public buy-in in order to have it be successful?
This is really this tension between the privacy and the effectiveness. And in fact, there's only really one country that seems to be particularly good at getting their app into the hands of the population, and that's actually Singapore. It also has very similar sorts of privacy protections. It encrypts data. It doesn't allow individuals to truly know who they come into contact with. So in many ways, it reflects this effort here in the United States. But even still, something like 18 or 19% of their population has downloaded their app, and it still really has not really been shown to be particularly effective. We know right now, in order for these sorts of digital tracing contact applications to actually be effective, you need almost universal buy-in. But considering that the United States doesn't have complete adoption of smartphone technologies anyway, something only like 80% that really will never be able to successfully replace the manual tracing with this kind of digital contact tracing.
Has manual contact tracing ever been used anywhere effectively for dealing with a pandemic?
Yes. So manual contact tracing is very common. It's being currently used in Singapore, in Hong Kong, in South Korea, and has actually been shown to be pretty effective at tracking down infections. Now, again, there are some very real privacy concerns with what those governments are doing. But it has been shown pretty universally that manual contact tracing, the kind of the hard, laborious task of figuring out where people have gone and then alerting other individuals who may have come into contact with them, that really has been shown to be effective. Moreover, states like Massachusetts and New York and California are spending a lot of money in hiring contact tracers currently in order to start this work, in order to trample down the pandemic. There's also been larger suggestions for something for the United States writ large. So there's been a number of different proposals that have come out, something along the lines of about $3.6 billion to about $7 billion is suggested for a United States-wide program. And moreover, there's already a CDC effort to at least start to begin tracking and some sort of surveillance effort. But we really don't have any great specifics about that right now, but it should be coming out in the next couple of weeks.
We have been talking with William Reinhart, who is senior fellow at the Center for Growth and Opportunity, that located at Utah State University. William, tell us a bit about the Center for Growth and Opportunity. Also, where can folks go on the web to learn more?
The Center for Growth and Opportunity is based out of Utah State. We're a research organization that's really interested in progress and productivity and getting people back to work. And obviously, we're really concerned about what's happening currently with the COVID and people's jobs. And this has really been one of the areas that my team has been working on pretty hard. You can find all of our work at thecgo.org. It's super simple.
William Reinhart with the Center for Growth and Opportunity. William, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Parkinson with the Club for Growth joins us every week here on American Radio Journal to talk about what's happening in Washington, D.C. and politically across the nation. Scott, good to have you here.
Good to be with you, Loman.
We're going to talk about Washington, D.C. to begin our segment this week. And President Trump this past week, Scott, issued a sweeping executive order to bring about the end or the reduction in a number of regulations. Tell us what the president did, and do you think it's going to have a significant impact?
This week, President Trump issued the Regulatory Relief to Support Economic Recovery executive order that's going to aggressively help cut red tape so that our economy can recover quickly from the crisis caused by the coronavirus pandemic. President Trump has already relaxed, modified, or waived over hundreds and hundreds of regulations that are currently crippling the U.S. economy. And this executive order is going to significantly change the environment that risk takers and those that are interested in business formation and really getting the economy reopened continue to face day by day with extraneous paperwork, labor provisions, environmental provisions, things related to the Administrative Procedures Act. And so we're incredibly encouraged by this gigantic step that the president has taken to provide regulatory relief. We think that it could have by far the greatest pro-growth economic impact of any executive order that the president has signed during his presidency.
If these types of reductions in regulations are good for the economy and help spur the economy in a crisis, is this something that we ought to look to being made permanent going forward?
Yeah, I think the goal here from the administration and the team at the Office of Management and Budget and their regulatory team was to provide for an executive order that would be incredibly hard to roll back. And what this is doing is it's instructing all the federal agencies to comb through and identify what regulations have impact on the economic recovery. So as you see various agencies from the Department of Labor to the Department of Transportation to the EPA identifying major rules and even insignificant rules that are hampering economic growth, those rules will be rolled back. And in order for them to be promulgated again, I think that you're going to have to see very, very strong economy. Otherwise, there's going to be damage inflicted by anybody that is a future president looking to roll back this executive order. Meanwhile, you could see Congress codify things that the administration has done. They could also pass legislation that can go even a little bit farther, like the RAINS Act, which would permanently instruct Congress to scrutinize these major rules and regulations. And we want to have people be on the record. We don't want an out-of-control, bureaucratic, administrative state. And putting more of the onus on our direct representation is a good thing. So Club for Growth is continuing to work with members of the Hill in both the Senate and the House to try to get deregulation included in a subsequent phase related to the economic crisis.
Meanwhile, around the country, Scott, governors are starting to reopen their states, and so-called red states seem to be doing it much more quickly and effectively than blue states. Your old boss, Ron DeSantis, this past week, governor of Florida, and Florida has been sort of the shining star of this. You want to talk a little bit about what Governor DeSantis has done and how effective it has been?
Governor DeSantis had an important video that got released this week while he was in Orlando with the vice president and talking to the press corps. You see, Florida has been really attacked repeatedly by members of the media that have a partisan agenda. And finally, DeSantis had enough and really stood up for himself, not just based on partisan politics, but based on the actual data and facts that have emerged following the coronavirus pandemic. You obviously have hotspot in New York City, and more people from New York City are going down to Florida than any other location in the entire world. So he's been able to actually mitigate the spread of the coronavirus with the steps that they've taken. I think people down there have done a good job with respecting each other and not going to extraneous limits to get each other sick, basically. But he, in this video, he compared Florida to other southern states, to Midwestern states, and obviously to the Acela corridor, New York to D.C. And Florida is actually doing pretty good when you look at the percentage of those infected and the numbers of deaths. Florida is the third largest state in the country. And what you saw this week from Governor DeSantis was a strong defense for his state and their ability to make decisions locally. And I think that's what most Americans want. We want to have sort of a zip code by zip code approach to reopening the economy. We don't want to treat New York City like we treat, let's say, Bakersfield, California. And we don't want to treat Phoenix, Arizona, the same way that we're going to treat Philadelphia. There are different circumstances on the ground, and you need to have local officials making decisions for their people. In addition to all that, I think that going forward, we're going to see continued legislative responses out of Washington. One line in the sand that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell drew this week that I think is very important to reopening the economy and actually incentivizing people to get back to work is ending the $600 per week unemployment benefit that right now has created a perverse incentive where people are making more on unemployment than they would in their job. And so Mitch McConnell announced that he's not going to go for an extension in any future phase, and holding him to that pledge will be important as negotiations continue.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, as always, tell us a little bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C., and our members are united in the idea of liberty and economic freedom. If your listeners are interested in checking us out, our website is www.clubforgrowth.org, and you can check us out on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Most states have issued so-called orders requiring businesses to close to fight the COVID-19 pandemic, but many are finding those orders are unenforceable. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports.
The extent and severity of the COVID-19 economic shutdowns vary from place to place. Depending on where you're listening to me from, you might be allowed to do everything from go out to a bar or restaurant, or you might be confined still to your home or apartment. But the one thing that almost all of these rules have in common is that they're, well, really not all that enforceable on a large scale. And we may have finally this week reached the point where most people are realizing that, even if many governments are still lagging behind. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a look at this ongoing COVID-19 economic shutdown, the lockdown, of course, that has cost millions of jobs across the country and tipped the country certainly into a recession. The big question at this point is really how long will these lockdowns remain in place and how long will the recovery take after they are lifted? And of course, all of that depends not just on what is done with the lockdowns, but what happens with the coronavirus pandemic. And when I say that these shutdowns are really unenforceable, I sort of mean two different things. On one hand, you have situations like what we saw in Ohio this week, where a state judge ruled that the COVID-19 lockdown imposed there was illegal because it exceeds the power that was granted by the statute under which it was imposed. And so that ruling coming on the heels of a similar ruling from a state court in Wisconsin a few weeks ago means that there's the beginnings of a legal and constitutional pushback against the extent to which governors and various other public officials have ordered businesses to shut down and ordered people to stay home. So on one hand, there's that legal and constitutional aspect, and I think you're going to see some of that gaining steam in the days and weeks to come. On the other hand, though, I think the enforceability question is really a question of practicality, and it's a question that has to deal with whether people are going to go along with these lockdowns voluntarily for much longer, because this was never really meant to be a long-term strategy, and I don't think it can be expected to be a long-term strategy. Case in point, look at what happened in Texas just this week, where the State Department of Regulation and Licensure decided to drop about 200 enforcement investigations into barbers and cosmetologists who had returned to work in recent weeks. The Dallas Morning News reported that the department is also dropping about 180 cases that it hadn't even begun investigating yet. They hadn't moved past the complaint stage. So that seems to me like a clear admission that enforcing the shutdown again is simply untenable. The turning point in Texas was a few weeks ago when a Dallas salon owner, Shelley Luther, you may have seen her on TV or at least heard her name, she was sentenced to spend 7 days in jail for reopening her business on April 24th. She said that she had to reopen her business because she wanted to feed her children. I mean, it wasn't because she was just defying a government order. She had a legitimate reason for doing it. The outrage that was generated by Luther's arrest and sentencing eventually convinced Governor Greg Abbott to remove jail time as a punishment for people who violate the state's stay-at-home order. And then the licensing department really went a step further by saying that it will allow the reopening of cosmetology and barbering establishments retroactive all the way back to April 2nd. And that wipes out any violations that may have been accumulated over the past 6 to 7 weeks. This is a shift. This is an important shift in the fight against the coronavirus, because this is going to be a long-term thing. And I think it's important not just for individuals and regular people to realize this is going to be a long-term thing, but for governments to realize that too, and to shift their strategies accordingly, because these lockdowns are simply untenable. They're, even if they were enforceable, they would be economically ruinous over the long term. The proper role for the government in all of this has always been more limited than either the bureaucrats who are drafting these stay-at-home orders imagine, or the protesters shouting about tyranny in front of state capitals fear. Forcibly quarantining 330 million people was never really possible, and the lockdowns have wrecked the economy while they've also slowed the spread of the disease over the past 2 months. But ultimately, this was always based on voluntary compliance. This was up to individuals deciding that they were going to stay home. Now, don't get me wrong. There have been plenty of heavy-handed enforcement of these lockdowns. We've saw people arrested for surfing in California and things like that. But that's been ineffective and perhaps even counterproductive, because any cop that gets close enough to issue a citation or make an arrest is hardly practicing social distancing. Imagine what a public health disaster it would be if they were actually somehow capable of detaining and fining everyone who broke quarantine. And it isn't because of the cops that people are practicing social distancing. Research from 538 shows pretty conclusively that most state-level stay-at-home orders actually came days or even weeks after most Americans were already staying home because they were worried about getting the virus back in March. That remains true in places where governments are fighting to maintain the lockdowns, even as compliance with them begins to fray. Like in my former home state of Pennsylvania, where Governor Tom Wolf has threatened businesses with the loss of their licenses if they go along with county-level reopening plans that are moving faster than his state-issued directives. And it remains true in places where the lockdowns have already been lifted, too. In Georgia, for example, Governor Brian Kemp has lifted many of the economic lockdowns there, but restaurant reservations were still 90% lower this past weekend than they were at the same time last year. So people are just choosing to stay home. Now, the biggest benefit that comes from lifting stay-at-home orders is an end to this charade about the way that such lockdowns actually work. Kemp didn't reopen Georgia any more than Wolf is keeping Pennsylvania closed. All he did was give people and consumers and businesses permission to choose their own acceptable levels of risk, something that people are going to do anyway in every state, regardless of what the official orders are the longer this goes on. Governments at all levels should continue to provide accurate information about what's relatively safe, like going to the beach or sitting outside and drinking, and what isn't safe, like getting together in big groups or using public transportation or really anything where you're close together in an enclosed space with other people. But the bottom line here is that enforcement should be reserved for where it can actually work. An official order closing stadiums seems reasonable. Jailing salon owners does not. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Baim. You can check out more of our coverage of the coronavirus, the economic consequences of these lockdowns, and everything else that's in the news right now by heading over to Reason.com. And you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
For many communities, the annual Memorial Day parade and ceremonies honoring our departed veterans will not be held this year. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College laments the loss on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Every year I attend the annual Memorial Day Parade in Mercer, Pennsylvania. It's pure Americana. Rotary Club, high school bands, snow cone stands, church groups, multiple veterans of wars, and flags, flags, flags everywhere. I've been attending since I moved to this area in 1997. And yet, not this year. For the Mercer Parade this year, the year of the COVID-19 pandemic, no one will be marching. The parade is canceled. And not just in little Mercer, Pennsylvania, but in small towns nationwide. What a shame. It's especially a loss because, well, we're losing so many World War II veterans. We lose more and more year by year. And many we're losing even more rapidly right now due to coronavirus in nursing homes. The vast majority of fatalities at the hands of this nasty virus are people in their 90s, quite a few of them men who served in World War II. I was particularly struck by the loss of World War II veterans during a moment last fall. I had picked up two of my daughters from church after youth group. I wasn't sure what had been on the agenda that afternoon. My daughter said, "Dad, we had an amazing experience. We went to a nursing home. We met two people who were almost 100 years old. Dad, they remembered World War II." It was a nice experience for them. Of course, I've met countless people who remembered World War II, who served in World War II. Pretty much any of us over the age of 30 to 40 have. Nonetheless, our kids, current-day teens or youngers, they're not meeting World War II veterans. Those veterans are a literal dying breed. A word of advice to our young people, meet these people when you can. They're not all in nursing homes. Some live right down the street. And that reminds me of another moment a few years ago. A friend of mine told me about an old-timer who lived on our street, whose house I drove by countless times. His name was Russ Post. "You got to meet this guy," my friend told me. "He has quite a story." So I decided to drop in on Russ, who was 89 years old. What followed was a memorable Saturday afternoon as Russ took my teenage son and I on a roller coaster ride from his youth in Western Pennsylvania to the Pacific Theater in World War II to the Korean War. To adequately capture the highlights of what Russ shared is impossible here, but perhaps most searing was what he witnessed at Saipan. Saipan became infamous. There in the summer of 1944, countless Japanese killed themselves in mass suicides. Russ and his crew approached the shore in horror. "I couldn't believe my eyes," Russ told me. "Horrible. People were jumping off the cliffs, women holding their babies. I don't care how tough you are, that makes your head scream." Yes, some of our veterans lived through things just like that. They live to tell, and they're not living much longer. This Memorial Day 2020, Russ is no longer with us. He passed away last April at age 94, just before Memorial Day. Ironically, he died at the nursing home that my daughters had just visited. I wish that they had met him. Unfortunately, the time for kids today to meet guys like Russ is fading fast, and there will not be many more Memorial Days with World War II veterans. It's a shame to miss one this year. Time is running out. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WHTY-AM in West Palm Beach, Florida, WYLF-AM in Pennon, New York, along with WWOS-FM in Orangeburg, South Carolina. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.